intern, we had I was there. So to give your audience some idea, I was at the Great March of Return, and I was in fact even shot myself at the Great March of Return while caring for patients. At the statistics were very clear. There were approximately, I don't remember the exact numbers now, but approximately 6,000, I believe it was 5,600 or something like this, gunshot wounds, of which over 80% were to the limbs, to the legs and arms. That, when you're talking about such close proximity, most people were within 100 meters of the shooters. That is an obvious and very deliberate policy, and especially because the way in which the Israelis did it. This is a policy in which the Israelis sort of exerted their control over Palestinian bodies and had clearly orders to maim Palestinians. At the GHF sites, what we're seeing is gunshots to the head. Like, the majority of gunshots are clearly intended to kill. Where the gunshots aren't sort of one shot, one kill, i.e., gunshots to the head and neck, they tend to be spread shots. So basically, what people tell me is the tank opened fire on a group of us. And those are the gunshots that we don't see in the head. The other thing that they're doing is they're dropping bombs or firing artillery shots into large groupings of people, because obviously there's a huge density. The way that the aid sites are set up are to funnel people into very dense groups of people. So firstly, they bring people long distances because these places are within the so-called Israeli safe zones, well, Israeli red zones, I guess, safe for the Israelis, not safe for Palestinians. And so they bring them into these Israeli red zones, and there they make everybody huddle. So already people are coming long distances, they're dehydrated, they're already hungry. There have been people who have died just trying to make the trip. Then when they get huddled, they often get shot at. They get artillery explosions because they get fired, artillery shelling upon them. They have anti-personnel grenades dropped on them by quadcopters. And then, of course, when that happens, it's not like people just stand there. People run. And so there are stampede-related injuries that will sometimes happen because people are panicked, people are running. Best case scenario is that there's this powerful tear gas that's used on them. And when all of that happens, it creates these many levels of injury where it's very common at our hospital at Nasser to get 250 or 300 patients in one day who are all injured. A good number of whom, I think this morning or yesterday, I'm losing track of days now, there were about 15 people who were killed at the aid site. So it's depraved, it's deliberate, and it's deadly.
It was Nashua Khan speaking with Dr. Tarek Labani in Gaza on Habibti Please. Find new episodes at HabibtiPlease.substack.com or wherever you get your podcasts, and at HarbingerMediaNetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from a recent episode, she sits down with On the Line Media's Samira Moyeddin in Toronto to talk about the United States' illegal attack on Iran and the late June launch of Canadian Journalists for Justice in Palestine.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop, the show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. Today, we're talking about the United States' illegal attack on Iran. Yeah, politicians are trying to say that it was legal, but international law experts say otherwise. And I'm inclined to listen to them over politicians. On top of all of that, CNN reporting on leaked intelligence suggests that the attack didn't even achieve the goal that politicians are using to justify this illegal act, the destruction of Iran's nuclear sites. Meanwhile, before the United States got involved at Israel's behest, Israel had already lobbed strikes on Iran, killing hundreds of Iranian civilians and prompting Iran to launch retaliatory strikes that killed 28 people in Israel. Altogether, the two countries fought for about 12 days before a tenuous ceasefire was struck. Well, one, Israel immediately violated, but that has otherwise held. But during those same 12 days, Israel killed at least 870 Palestinians in its ongoing genocide on Gaza. This is the reality that prompted a group of journalists titled Canadian Journalists for Justice in Palestine to speak out this week with a press conference to remind us of our professional and ethical duties. Quote, to report courageously, to challenge power unequivocally, and to fiercely protect the integrity of our profession and the safety of our colleagues. The world is watching and history will remember how we respond. Samira Moyeddin, an award-winning Iranian-Canadian journalist, was among those who spoke out this week. It's not a surprise she was there. Samira has been fearlessly reporting on the genocide, putting many folks with far more institutional support to shame. On top of that, she has both the lived and journalistic experience to provide Canadians with essential context. That's why I am so thrilled to welcome Samira on the show today. Samira, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me.
Thank you for being on. I am so excited to have you here. I was actually just listening last night to your interview for The Hatchet, and it was incredible. Like, I learned so much about your story, and it's you're a total badass. Yeah, I listened to it last night. It was so good. Now, I wanted to start out. Obviously, it's been a very big week or couple weeks and months and years in the news. But I want to start by asking you to kind of help Canadians understand the situation that we saw in Iran over the last 2 weeks, because you have a level of expertise and context that you bring to the table that I think is incredibly important right now. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you have noticed in the coverage of these both American and Israeli attacks on Iran?
Yeah, I think Rachel, the biggest, it's not even a misconception, it's almost a promulgation of a lie, is that Iran is the aggressor here. Well, it's not. I think that is the biggest thing. And the other biggest thing is that Iran was a nuclear threat. You know, Rafael Grossi already came out. This is the general director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and said Iran was years away, years from being able to develop any sort of bomb. And that's if Iran wanted to develop a bomb. There was no indication of that happening. And then the other thing that I think is important to point out is that we don't even know, you know, after the U.S. bombed Fordo, we don't really know at this point what really that bomb did. According to CNN, you know, it didn't destroy the entire area. To which, you know, Trump responded by calling CNN scum when it put out this report. So we don't know. And then the other thing, I mean, this isn't a big thing and people might not know this, but Iran is a country that sits on some of the most seismic faults in the world. It is so prone to earthquakes. And I was watching this video that the Wall Street Journal had made, and they were talking to a person named Tom Krakow, who's from a weird outfit called Missile Defense Systems. And he was basically explaining this 30,000-pound bomb. This is a non-nuclear bomb that the U.S. has never used before. Wow. It is the largest non-nuclear bomb that you could use. It's a 30,000-pound bomb. And he was basically on camera saying, what you want to do is penetrate with one bomb, so one 30,000-pound bomb, and then you drop another one to go even further down. And then he looks in the camera and he says, you basically want to cause an earthquake. And I was thinking to myself, this is wild, because 12 hours before the U.S. dropped this bomb, Fox News, Wall Street Journal, NBC, and even Scientific American and the CBC's David Common were all explaining in a weird sort of reverie and in awe of this bomb. They were all like, this is what it can do, and this is what it does. And I was like, there is no at all talk of what the environmental and human risks are of exploding such a thing. Iran was basically Nagasaki 2.0 testing ground for the U.S. when it dropped this bomb on Fordo, Natanz, and in in Esfahan. So we still don't know yet what the ramifications of it were. But these are the types that this is the rhetoric that is so dangerous that the media just like pushes. And, it, you know, again, humans are totally just out of the equation whenever we're seeing these types of broadcasts. And so it's very troubling. I mean, at least to me, you know.
Absolutely. It should be troubling to everyone. It's unfortunately, it doesn't always seem to be, but it should be. I think that, you know, one thing that I've found really striking are the assumptions that have been baked into coverage of this. Like, you know, you're talking about people discussing the way the bomb works and talking about this bomb with a reverie. This was an illegal act. Even if, you know, politicians are coming out saying,
do we even care what's illegal anymore? Like, international law even exists.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, you know, the United States and Israel that are attacking international law and setting precedents of, you know, international law for some countries and not for others. And meanwhile, Canada is supporting these actions while claiming to be a world leader in international law. And I think it's
so
infuriating.
Painful listening to Carney. Listening to Carney over the past week has been so painful. And his comment yesterday about, we have a Palestinian state as long as it's Zionist. What?
I literally had a question at the end of the interview about this for you because I had to ask you about that.
We can come back to it then. Yeah.
Okay. We'll put a pin in it. So you guys got to stick around because we got some good stuff coming. But, you know, I think that a question that a lot of folks have here, like, especially when you consider all of the stuff you just laid out, right, is why? I mean, if the purported goal was to destroy the nuclear sites, first of all, it failed. And if the purported goal was to stop Iran from having nuclear weapons, all the experts that I have heard from, and you can let me know if this reflects your understanding as well, because you know way more about this than I do, say that this, if anything, would create more interest in weaponization. And this is, I'm just going to quickly explain this for the listeners. The way that you make a nuclear bomb, I'm not giving you a guide right now, but you know the steps that a state has to have in order to do it is they have to know how to enrich uranium. Iran knows how to do that, but there are civilian purposes for that. You can use it for nuclear power. You can use it for all kinds of things. This is a technology that other countries are able to use and have that self-determination to have their own energy programs. But once you enrich uranium up to 60%, it kind of speed runs, and it's faster months rather than years to get to 90%, which is the point that you need to hit to be able to put it in a nuclear weapon. But even if you have, as Iran does, a stockpile of 60%, you aren't months away because you have to be able to take that 90% and put it into a warhead. That is called weaponization. It is extremely specialized knowledge that Iran would have to go out of its way to obtain. And it has shown no indication to want to obtain that. So it is not on the cusp of dropping a bomb on anyone. And I think that reality and all of the misinformation and the assumptions being made that this was somehow protecting the world from Iran's nuclear program, when if anything, it just exacerbated that risk, which also Israel has, it's widely believed to have nuclear weapons and hasn't committed to the same level of monitoring. And sorry, I'm just ranting at this point, but my point is, what that clearly isn't the goal. To destroy Iran's nuclear program, they're either just really bad at achieving their goals or that's not the goal. So what do you think the USA and Israel were actually trying to achieve here?
I think there were a number of things. I think that first and foremost, this was a war of distraction. Distraction from the genocide that Israel is conducting in Gaza. And it did a great job. Gaza fell way down, you know, maybe on page 12 of any paper. And so that was completed, you know, check mark that. The other thing is that a lot of people don't pay attention to is the propaganda embedded within what Israel is trying to do in Iran, which is regime change. Yes. So this Operation Rising Lion really appeals to a level of nostalgia that Iranians have about what their country was before the 1979 revolution. And so the IDF has a IDF Persian page where I start my mornings every day. It's on Instagram. And it really sets out to me what is being promulgated towards Iranians, both inside and outside of the country. And it's been quite effective. They do it in the Persian language. They use a mixture of nostalgia, misinformation, and quick, rapid sort of imagery, you know, that combines the two. That is something that really needs to be looked at. I look at it all the time and I talk about it as much as I can. And then the other thing I think was to really use this bomb to see what happens when you use it. Because this isn't about Iran's nuclear capabilities or, you know, developing a bomb. Iran's nuclear energy program began in 1975. Now, under the Shah, this is Mohammad Reza Shah pre-revolution, Iran realized that it needs to provide, you know, electricity, nuclear energy, like all of that stuff that a state does and is allowed to do. And in fact, the prime minister of Iran at the time in 1975, Prime Minister Hoveyda, came and visited the Pickering nuclear energy site here in Ontario. So they had started this program, but the revolution stopped it. This is what's interesting. The revolutionaries and the new government.
That was an excerpt from a recent episode of Bubble Pop. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at rachelgilmore.substack.com and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, the Progress Report from Edmonton-based public interest journalism outlet Progress Alberta has been detailing the good and mostly bad of Alberta politics since 2019. On this highlight from a new episode, co-host Jim Story and Jeremy Appel sit down with city councillor and longtime progressive politics organizer Michael Jans to talk about city council voting blocks and Edmonton's upcoming municipal election. Now, here's Jeremy and Jim.
Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Progress Report podcast. It is June 23rd, and we are recording from Amiskwichi Waskagan in Treaty 6 territory, otherwise known as Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jim Story, and we've got, of course, our other co-host, Jeremy Appel. Jeremy, how are you doing today?
Good.
Well, folks, I do have some happy news to report. Last week, you may have seen from us either online or heard us in the pod or read in the newsletter that we were in a bit of a finance crunch. Things looked pretty bad. We weren't sure if we were going to be able to keep things going past the end of the month. Jeremy and I didn't get paid last week. We're clearing that up this week. But it turns out that we really underestimated how much support was out there for us. As soon as we said that we needed a little help, it just seems like everyone showed up. The support that people have been offering is so generous, not just from individuals, but also from a lot of our friends in the movement. You know, Friends of Medicare offered to help us out. Public Interest Alberta sent out a little appeal on our behalf this morning. And everyone coming together, you did it. You pulled us out of the hole. The work will continue. I am very, very happy to report that.
We did it.
Well, our guest today is someone that I've got a bit of a long history with myself. When he was coming up through student politics at my alma mater, I was coming up with through student journalism. So we've had a bit of a synergistic relationship over the years. I'm very happy to invite today's guest, the present counselor for Ward Papasteo, Michael Jans. Michael, how are you?
Awesome. It's actually coming up on our 20-year friendiversary, Jim. Since you covered me, I think, in 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an interesting story back then. Kind of your first opportunity to shake a fist at a big corporation. It was the Aramark people who were squeezing the students at the University of Alberta pretty hard for their meal plans.
Yeah, and thankfully we organized students, we had a petition, and we were able to push back and demand a fair deal for students. And we were thankful that the Gateway was there to cover it. And it actually got citywide media attention. I think it was quite novel for them to come and cover a food fight, so to speak.
Well, the Gateway continues to put out great work. Their coverage of the crackdown on the pro-Palestine encampments, I thought, was very good a few months ago.
Yeah, I know. It was quite courageous.
Well, shout out to the kids. Doing great work. Keep it up. Well, Michael, you've got a lot of work ahead of you because we are, 120 days? Is it 120 or 119 away from the next municipal election here in Edmonton?
Yeah, around that.
I think the best place for us to start would be if you could describe to us what your perception is of where the camps line up on the current city council. There was some good research a little while back. I think this was a Matthew Black. Matthew Black, maybe I'm attributing this incorrectly. I'm going to have to go and put this one in the show notes. But someone did a bit of analysis on who the voting blocks were on council. But I'd like to hear from you, you know, what are the camps on council right now?
You know, it's interesting. When you ask me that question, the first thing I think of is, don't judge us by our words, judge us by our budget. And by and large, when you look at the budget passed by city council, that's where I think you see the most alignment. You see councillors who, a vast majority, I think 9 or 10, wanted to spend more money on public transit, more money on housing, more money on affordable housing, more money on public services, on extending library hours, on extending pool times, on just sort of those bread and butter issues that matter to Edmontonians. And then you had a couple who seemed to be curmudgeons who were opposed to any of those good things that make a city worth living in. But by and large, I'd say when it comes down to the fundamentals, when you look at the four-year budget, when you look at where we're building, you do see a lot of alignment. I think generally on, say, housing issues, for the most part, you see a lot of councillors committed to building more houses in more places where people want to live, especially close to transit. I would say you'll have these sort of nuanced disagreements in sometimes the fine print around different issues. But by and large, I think you see... you see a council that has been committed to spending more funding and on those core city issues like parks and snow removal and roadways and things like that. And that's been quite exciting. And I think as Edmonton's been growing and as we have a lot of our people here, this is, you know, one of the most important things we can do for eliminating poverty, for racial justice, for social justice. If we're not investing in public transit, if we're not investing in affordable housing, if we're not investing in building a more affordable Edmonton, everything else gets worse down the line.
That's an interesting look at it from the inside, because from the outside, I perceive there to be basically two camps, and maybe one of them has like a sub camp to it, which would be that there are the quote unquote progressive councillors, and then there are the quote unquote conservative councillors, and the conservatives being Tim, Sarah, and then the couple of Yahoos over to their right, who are kind of a little sub faction there. And then over on the other side of things, you seem to be mostly within the progressive power block, except with a bit of a cleavage when it comes to policing issues. That seems to be the one where you stick your neck out a little more than anyone else.
I don't know that that's entirely true. Like, I think council generally has had the same concerns that I have around policing. We've seen an intransigent provincial government that's been more concerned about politics than policing, such as when they've been appointing police commissioners, provincial police commissioners, when they've been defunding the police by reducing funding through photo radar revenue or other measures like that. We've seen unprecedented policing interference from the provincial government. And I think you've heard pushback from a number of councillors. After all, it was Councillor Kieran Tang who motioned that we should have an audit of police services. So I think generally people have shared many of the same concerns that I have. I think we've had some tensions over whether there should be a guaranteed funding formula or not. But generally, I think a lot of Edmontonians and City Council have been concerned about these issues.
Perhaps the cleavage is more just in terms of behavior than if you guys are all voting the same way, because I certainly don't see, Tang or Salvador or Rutherford getting into it in social media fights with the police chief or the police union president.
Well, I think they weren't targeted by them. I mean, we heard, I think it was actually your former colleague who reported the story about you know, the tensions that former Chief McPhee or his he was frustrated that I had hadn't recognized him and shaken his hand, and I was targeted by the former police union president Mike Elliott with, you know, 23 code of conduct complaints in my first year. They seemed particularly interested in trying to silence me off the hop, you know, I think I have a, it's interesting, I have a good relationship with the current police union president, Curtis Hoopel. I have, I was on the police podcast recently. I generally have, I would say, a good working relationship with the rank and file and actually the both the commission and also some of the leaders in the service. I think there's still open criticisms that I have of the institution and the justice system and everything else. But I think, you have different personalities there now that are much more concerned about safety than playing politics. The fact that John McDougall is no longer chair of the police commission, that Ben Henderson is there, you've seen a marked improvement in the tone, the transparency, the engagement between Chair Ben Henderson and Vice Chair Shazia Miri. They've been fantastic. They, the last time the police were at council, it was one of the most productive conversations we have. And in fact, I would actually say that it was almost a different tag team. It was me and the police chief going after the minister over the photo radar and the lack of action on traffic safety issues. I think many Edmontonians underestimate that the most dangerous part of our city is actually our roadways and the serious motor vehicle accidents, the serious speeding, street racing, fatalities, dangerous driving. These are major killers. And the police have been urging the government to take action. They've been urging different tools. One area of agreement Chief McPhee and I had was that if somebody's speeding, 30 over the limit or 50 over the limit, that their vehicle should be compounded impounded and confiscated. And whether we're talking about that, the dangerous driving with motorcycles, with street racing, with everything else, there's actually a lot of common ground that the police and I have. That, and when I speak with rank and file members, they're just as frustrated with the justice system. They're just as frustrated with the lack of supports available, the lack of shelters, day shelters, 24/7 shelter spaces. They don't, you know, I was talking to one BCOP who said, you know, I got into this to catch bank robbers. I didn't get into this to be, you know, a glorified taxi service for helping people who are unhoused getting from one place to another. We should have other supports. And that's one of the things I've been pushing for investment in. We've had historic investment in 24/7 crisis diversion. We've had more investments in public health supports and other steps that we can have to actually unburden the police, to actually make sure that officers are there for when people truly need them, for the things that only the police can do. And many of these other social supports and this other work can be done more affordably or maybe better by social agencies, frontline agencies, etc. And that's I think really, really important to consider.
Dealing with the perceptions around policing is probably going to be a big challenge for your campaign. I think the province has been going very hard on a law and order message for at least a couple of years now, and there are a lot of voices supporting them in the media, both corporate and even kind of freelance mercenaries.
Excerpt from the new episode of The Progress Report. Find the more than 150 episode archives at progressreport.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 31 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now on Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. See you back here next week with a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. online at cjsf.ca. Broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Home of McFog the Dog.